Bell for the 12 o'clock news.
Should I just sit in for Liz, do you think?
You
and
could.
You can just fake it like
you
that.
Could. You could pretend you're
Why not? We need more voices.
Right. I'm really sorry.
You know, for a while.
Not
connect. You know, we're going to get started in five minutes. I'm going to have to go and do that.
Okay.
Okay.
Just get up and leave quietly and
All
come
right.
back quietly.
All
right. Okay. I'm going to do two openings, John, just because there's still hope that maybe we'll get the other two in later and can patch it together. Hello, I'm Carla Tanella, executive producer here at KUAC, and with me here is John Adams, the producer of KUAC's new music program, and one of the two John Adamses who are contemporary composers. This John is the Alaskan version. And we've come together in front of these microphones to talk with three Windham Hill artists who are visiting Fairbanks this week, and they are Alex Degrassi, Liz Story, and Michael Hedges, two very different guitarists, and Liz is the pianist in this gathering. And, well, let's start with Alex. Okay. Take two. Hello, I'm Carla Tanella, executive producer here at KUAC, and here with me is John Adams, the producer of KUAC's new music program, and one of the two John Adamses who are contemporary composers. This John is the Alaskan version, and we've come together here in front of these microphones to talk with one of the three Windham Hill artists who are visiting Fairbanks this week, and that is Alex Degrassi. Hi.
Hi. Glad to be here.
We'd like to start talking about what in the world is Windham Hill. You know, one of the things that I notice no matter where I go is that many, many record stores have a bin set aside for Windham Hill records. You don't seem to fit into any of the other classifications very comfortably. And as a matter of fact, that's even true here at KUAC in our record library. Windham Hill is the mm-hmm. one grouping of records that has its own shelf as opposed to being in there by author or composer. So what is this phenomena called Windham Hill?
Well, it's a record label that was founded by Will Ackerman, who also has five albums out on the label. He started the label, I think, in the mid-70s, sort of by accident, almost, you might say. He was working as a contractor, building contractor at the time, and had been playing guitar over the years and had been doing it mostly for friends or on occasion in conjunction with a local theater group. And basically, he was playing acoustic guitar that really didn't, which people might have called folk guitar at the time, and but it was his own style, and it was somewhat traceable back to other American guitar players like John Fahey or Leo Kottke, that sort of thing, because the nature of using various different tunings and so forth with a guitar rather than a standard tuning. So he started the label sort of just for fun. He was encouraged by friends to make a recording, which he did, which he then made into a record and pressed up 250 copies and collected $5 from all his friends in advance to fund the project. And then hand-pasted the covers together and everything and turned them around and gave them to people. And one thing he hadn't counted on was that a few copies seemed to have made it into the hands of radio stations here and there, and it created a little bit of interest on the part of both the radio stations and the listeners, and people began to say, well, where do you get these, and where do they come from, and what is this company, and what do you call this kind of music? And that's how it got started. Today, the company is a fairly large and successful independent record label, which is, as of last year, being distributed by A&M Records, which is in turn distributed by RCA Records. And but the question of what is this music still seems to be a big one.
Well, now some people either put it in a classification such as new music, or some people call it folk jazz or mellow jazz or
new age jazz.
Right.
But what Carla's getting at, I guess, is that it seems that Windham Hill is almost a generic term now.
Well,
she's saying you go into a store and there's the Windham Hill bin. What is it?
Well, I think that's largely the result of the fact that when the label started, when Will Ackerman's first records came out, when my first records came out, people were putting the record into folk bins in the record stores. But sometimes it would turn up in the, the bluegrass bins or even the classical bins. Mm-hmm. So right from the beginning, there was a problem with that. I think now when you see the Windham Hill label sort of put into its own category, that's a result of not being able to really fit it into any category. A lot of the records now, because some of them are selling fairly well and they get charted, as they say, in the trade magazines, are being put on the jazz charts. And some of the music, I think, lends itself more to the jazz audience than others, but I think what's happening is that the music is filling a gap between what has been, thought of in the past as folk music, rock and roll, jazz, and classical. In other words, I think it's filling a gap for people, that is, an audience that may have grown up on rock and roll and folk music in the 60s and got into jazz for a while but weren't hardcore jazz fans. Mm-hmm. and enjoyed classical music but weren't necessarily hardcore classical listeners. And it's sort of, I think, it's in the middle of all that, and I think that's why it's getting its own classification.
I think a lot of people also take the Windham Hill logo as sort of a standard of trust. And in fact, the people go into record stores and may ask for not the latest William Ackerman album, but may ask for what's new on Windham Hill.
Well, there certainly is a continuity in both the type of music and in the actual quality of the recordings and pressings and so forth. It's been Will Ackerman's intention and subsequently all the other people involved in the label to really do the best recording and not save any money on recording expenses or try and cut corners on pressing or using less than really top quality vinyl and mastering facilities and all that sort of thing. So the result is, I think, a lot of people have been very impressed with the actual sound quality of the recordings.
And that concern seems to go even beyond the vinyl itself into the design of the covers. I remember reading something somewhere about the concern that there was a 4 mil vinyl wrapping on the cover to protect it, and I know that the record sleeve on the inside is the equivalent of what I go out and buy extra money to put my best records into.
Right. Well, they've always, it's always been the standard, for the label to really use the finest packaging and so forth, as well as to really make an effort to keep a consistency and a high quality to the graphic work and the color separation and the printing and all the things that go into actually packaging a record.
Well, there definitely is a Windham Hill feel to every album that you see. You recognize it even before you find the logo on the jacket. I'm wondering if that doesn't extend also to the feel for working with and for Windham Hill as an artist.
Well, I think it does generally. Of course, the label is still small enough so that all the people that record for the label and work for it in one capacity or another seem to know each other and have some kind of personal rapport, which is real good, I think. on the other hand, it has gotten very, it has grown so much over the last few years that at the same time, it's becoming a little bit more of a maze to find out what's going on at any one time or get a hold of somebody that you need to talk to. So there's both. I mean, I think it is a pretty close-knit group of people. There's always been an emphasis on, having a personal rapport with the people that you're working with and not just viewing it as, well, into the studio and here's some stranger who's going to be the engineer and here's the producer who is just somebody who's there to make sure that you don't spend too much time and money in the studio. I think it's a, even though it's grown as fast as it has in the last couple of years, there's always been it's been part of the intention of the label to not put out too many records too quickly, so that each recording project in the studio and after the recording is made into a record gets the kind of attention that it should get and that they've always been getting throughout the years, so that, you know, each record that comes out is sort of a special event.
Right,
you know?
And there's only, what, about something like 12 a year or something like that?
Yeah, really, well, they're up to about 30 in the catalog now, and this year there'll probably be about, 10 or 12 released. Generally, there's about two that come out every 2 months, and most recently, that's been Michael Hedges' album, Aerial Boundaries, and an album by Michal O'Donnell, formerly of the Celtic group, the Bothy Band, and Billy Oskay, his partner, called Night Noise, which is, again, it's hard to describe, but it's got a little bit of the Celtic influence, but it's definitely not traditional Celtic music.
I also hear rumors that there's plans afoot for a Gregorian chant with Hammered Dulcimer album.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't been totally up to date recently. I've been, one gets busy traveling around playing concerts and involved in their own work. So, but I have heard that rumor for a while now. There are a couple. Things that have grown out of the label. One is the reissue label, Lost Lake Arts, mm-hmm. which has reissued a Bola Sete album, the Brazilian guitar player, from an old Tacoma recording, as well as George Winston's album that came out in the early 70s on Tacoma called Ballads and Blues. And most recently, an album of guitar music by the English guitarist John Renborn.
Yes, I just played that a few nights ago for people. It's a lovely, lovely album. There's also plans for a possible other subsidiary label that will be vocal.
Yeah, this is the West River label, which you mentioned, which has been in the works for some time. And I think it's going to actually happen soon, which will be since Windham Hill has up to now been known as an instrumental label, starting off with solo guitar and solo piano and mm-hmm. then going into duets, and now there's a band, Shadowfax, and so forth. They've wanted to keep that continuity of the label as an instrumental music label. There will be West River then will be a sort of a branch of Windham Hill, which will specialize in vocal music. And I think there'll be quite a variety of music, as you say, because there'll be, if this Gregorian chant album comes out, that certainly will be different. And Michael Hedges, who is not only a fine guitar player, but also a singer-songwriter, is just getting ready to record songs that he's written over a period of time. So I think there'll be some other projects too, but I don't really know what they're going to be. So
we'll just have to keep our eyes open for that. I presume that those will find their way into the proverbial Windham Hill bin.
I think so.
Okay. There's another interesting thing about Windham Hill, too, that is a little different from what the most record companies do, and that is you put out samplers that are bought for themselves. Samplers are normally not high-selling items, and have recently put out, or not too long ago, put out an album called Windham Hill Live, which seemed to be a new turn where several Windham Hill artists played together.
Right. That was that was an album that was recorded in the fall of 1982 at the Berklee Performance Center and at the Berklee School of Music in Boston. That was a show that that happened there involving several of the Windham Hill musicians, solos, duets, trios, quartets, various things. That was then the record. Then is just the, you know, sort of selections from that evening.
Mm-hmm.
And I was involved in that, not only as a musician but as one of the producers, by virtue of organizing the whole event and sort of being in charge of coming up with a concert program for the whole evening. Since then, the concept that was sort of born out of that project has been continued here and there on occasion in the form of Windham Hill Live concerts, which we did one in the Greek Theater in Berklee, California last summer, which went on for about 3 or 4 hours and involved about 8-10 different acts, I guess is the way to describe it. So, and there's some more of those planned. I think there'll be one in Vancouver this summer, as well as Seattle, San Francisco, and San Diego. So I think we'll see more of those.
And that's what you're doing here in Fairbanks now.
Yeah.
Have you and Liz and Michael played together as three people before? Or I know you've been connected in the same concerts, but not necessarily playing.
We haven't really played together as a trio. It's kind of an odd combination, two guitars and piano. Michael and Liz have done a fair amount of traveling together and have recorded and played a couple things together. Likewise, Liz and I have traveled and played a fair amount together and have a few pieces that we've played together. So I'm not really sure here at the Solstice Festival what's going to happen with regard to that. But
well, you and Michael are so different in your guitar styles.
Yeah, but there's always a way to find a common ground. The problem, I think, in this particular case here is that we haven't really had a chance to hang out for a while, so we aren't really rehearsed or prepared necessarily to play things together, but I'm sure there'll be a couple duets, if not a trio or two.
Well, before we move into talking about your music specifically, what out of your four albums that
right.
you've done now? Crap, I just heard a tone in my headphones.
Yeah.
Did you hear it?
Yeah. But I don't know what it was.
Is John in the control room? Which of those four albums, I'm asking you for one cut out of those four albums that well, might be your favorite.
Oh, that's really tough to say. For me, usually whatever is new and current is usually more favorite for me. In other words, even if it's something I made up yesterday that I haven't recorded yet. So that's a tough one to say. I don't know, maybe the piece Turning Back, which is actually recorded in two parts on the first album, then recorded again in an expanded version on the live album. That's a fun one for me. I think it covers a lot of great... It's a long piece, and it covers a lot of different effects or whatever in terms of the guitar playing. So maybe that one.
Well, let's listen to that now then. Go ahead and sit down. I'm just taking a break. I'll give you a chance to get in here.
Sorry, that was all necessary. Now I have an hour.
Swell.
Good. I've got about 15 minutes.
10 or 15 minutes. Okay.
What did I miss? Everything.
Okay. So
mostly the label.
Mostly the label stuff. I only have one more question to ask about your music, and it's kind of a peripheral question, and then I'll turn it over to John for musical questions. I noticed that at least you and Michael, and I'm not sure if this is true of anybody else, but I've seen the name Irvin Samogi.
Samogi, excuse me.
And I that's really interesting to me because I know Irvin. I took flamenco guitar lessons from him many, many years ago. Uh-huh. And I'm wondering, I remember when he just started building guitars and before he got his business, and I'm really pleased to see that he's so successful, but what's so special about his guitars that you all are buying them and using them?
Well, he's building a steel string guitar mostly these days, which is, you know, been called a folk guitar in the past, but I think that concept is changing now. I mean, people don't think of them as necessarily as folk guitars so much anymore. I think they're real well made guitars for one, and they have a big sound, and they have a lot of variation in what's called tone color in guitar lingo. He's, as you say, when you took flamenco guitar lessons from him, he was pondering a career as a flamenco guitarist, and when he first started building guitars, he started building flamenco mm-hmm. and classical guitars and lutes, and then he started experimenting with steel string guitars. I suspect that the fact that he started out building those types of guitars and then got into steel string guitars, that he brought something from that tradition of, you know, classical and flamenco guitars into his way of building steel string guitars. I haven't played, I've played very few steel string guitars that have the tonal range that those mm-hmm. guitars have. They, you know, I mean, you can get a very metallic sound out of them, and you can get a very dark, deep mm-hmm. sound, and many steel string guitars have a very homogeneous sound. Mm-hmm. That's what I particularly like about them, in addition to the fact that they play very well, and he spends a lot of time working on them, so they're very... very finely built in detail. I don't know. You know, it's a mystery in a way. What makes a good instrument, and what makes an instrument the kind of instrument mm-hmm. that you want to play? So, but I think he's been very successful, and he's won some awards at luthiers conventions around the country and so forth. So, I just think they're great guitars, and they record very well too. That's the other thing.
They seem to sound more mellow than what I'm used to hearing when I hear steel guitar.
Well, you and Michael both play those.
Well, Michael has another one that he usually travels with. I think he's used the Samogi for recording on his first album and on a couple occasions in the studio. And I think Will Ackerman's got one now that he uses. They record exceptionally well because they have what's called a very good flat response. They a lot of times when you get into the studio with a guitar or any instrument, to get the kind of sound that you want, a lot of times you need to EQ, you know, boost mm-hmm. the treble, the bass, or take the bass out or something. The Samogi guitars seem to need very little of that in the studio.
Oh, I'm not sure exactly how this relates, but listening to your playing and then listening to Michael's, perhaps we can fit this into the context of you both playing on the same guitar, at least on, you say on his album he was playing a Samogi, right? On Breakfast in the Field.
Yeah.
There's a tremendous difference in sound to me. I mean, your touch is very, very light almost a classical mm-hmm. kind of sound, mm-hmm. and Michael's is much more percussive and you know, mm-hmm. delightfully so. I love the sounds he gets out of the guitar, but I just wonder if you could comment on that with regard to the guitars and your own personal playing styles.
I think it has less to do with the actual guitar and more to do with both the style and in to some extent the way that the album is actually recorded, or the way that he sets himself up when he performs. Michael uses pickups primarily to in the recording and also in playing to carry the sound. Mm-hmm. And his pickup situation is fairly unique in that he uses one that sort of catches all the very, very high end.
Yeah, it's a bright
sound, as well as another one which gets more than the mid range and the low end. So that's one element, whereas I've in recording relied pretty much just on the microphone, mm-hmm. or a pair of microphones. And the other aspect of that is that Michael's got a very innovative style of playing, and he does use a very percussive approach. He does a lot of slapping the strings, mm-hmm. and releasing the strings with his left hand and interchanging the traditional roles of the right and left hand when he plays. He does a lot of playing on the neck with the right hand, which is something that most people don't do. And finally, I guess I might say that I think because he's also a singer and a songwriter and so forth, I think he's got a little bit more of a, he comes into this whole thing with a little bit more of a little bit more of a rock and roll feel, mm-hmm. although certainly it's not rock and roll that he's playing, whereas maybe I come into it with a little bit more of a folk or a jazz approach to it than he does. So it's real interesting. I mean, everybody, it's the same instrument, but everybody gets such a different sound. For example, I've always been amazed at one of my favorite instruments is the soprano saxophone.
Oh, yes.
And Wayne Shorter is one of my favorite musicians, the sound that he gets is, I just think, is amazing. But then you'll turn around and see another great soprano sax player get a totally different color out of it. You know, it's just, I think it's the same thing with guitars.
I don't know if you've talked about this already in my absence, but I'd be curious to hear you talk about your own personal musical and other influences. What is it that makes your music sound like it does?
Probably because in a way... I'm largely self-taught. I'm not entirely self-taught. I played trumpet when I was a little kid in school bands and orchestras and got sort of a real fundamental grounding in music. And I never really enjoyed playing the trumpet that well. So I gave up when I was about 12 or 13 years old and picked up the guitar. And when I started playing the guitar, I was playing by ear, playing mostly folk and blues and a little bit of rock and roll. And then over the years, I got particularly interested in the British Isles style of playing, as exemplified by people like John Renbourn, who we were just talking about, and Bert Jansch and Davy Graham. So I kind of got into that as a way of getting into the guitar as a solo instrument, as sort of a complete sound in itself. Mm-hmm. And that sort of led me into playing a little bit of classical guitar here and there. And eventually I took some jazz lessons and played electric guitar for a few years and played in a band that was sort of a fusion band, I guess. And I've tried to expose myself to a lot of different styles of playing, but either because I've always wanted to play my own music or, depending on how you look on it, because I've never really stuck with learning or mastering a style in particular. I think that's how I've come up with my style, which is, sort of a blend of different influences.
Is your background? I know a little bit about Michael and Liz. It seems that your background is somewhat similar to theirs, huh? Or theirs are similar to. To yours? These are people that have come out of a pretty diversified musical background and then somehow found their own style, their own voice in the process.
Well, I think probably what we have in common is that I'm a little bit older than both Michael and Liz, but I think probably what a lot of the people in the Windham Hill label have in common is that the 60s and the early 70s were a big influence in all the big rock bands and you know, the whole psychedelic era and that whole thing when it just sort of exploded and it was sort of, that was the scene, you know. And I'm sure today if you're a teenager, it's the same thing, you know, but it's a new, it's a different scene now. But I think that was something that influenced us all, even though Liz was, learning to play classical piano at that time. She's got a fairly strong background in classical piano. And Michael, who went to the Peabody Institute in Baltimore, studied classical guitar and composition. But nevertheless, that whole kind of thrust, that which was more than music, but also a kind of a whole social attitude and the Vietnam War, you know, the whole thing. What can I say? But I think that made a big impact and it kind of opened people's minds to say, well, let's try and, blend different things together here. You know,
There's another aspect to that, too, and I don't want to get too off the subject, so, John, you can grab it back in a minute. And that is, last week we were talking with one of the co-founders of Apple Computer, Steve Wozniak, and it struck me that there are a lot of, say, children of the 60s who have gone into business and made success starting in their garages, in a sense, or in a cottage industry respect, and always with some new and innovative ways of doing things. Certainly the Apple computer was...
Celestial Seasonings.
Right, yeah, there you go.
And Windham Hill has done that, and even into distributing their records in health food stores and things like that. So it just struck me in the last couple of weeks how really remarkable the 60s were in giving us grown-up alternatives that we're still enjoying.
Well, I graduated from high school in 1970 and graduated from college in 1979, and which means that I dropped out of college, I think, four times and traveled, around Europe and Mexico and worked as a carpenter for a while and played my guitar in the subways in London for 2 months with a, guitar case out in front of me. And I think that there was definitely a strong bent to an alternative lifestyle then, and people didn't necessarily accept, this is the way to get to here. And, you know, if you want to be a musician, you do this, and if you want to be a rock musician, you do this, and if you want to be a classical musician, you do this, and if you want to be a jazz musician, you do this. I think, that has something to do with it, too. You know, I never was really sure what I wanted to do. I could listen to Pete Seeger and Miles Davis, side by side and enjoy them both equally well, and listen to, a Mozart piano concerto and still enjoy that, So I think... perhaps that's something that I learned, and I think a lot of people learned during that time, is that, even though it's ironic in a way because it kind of stemmed out of the counterculture, whatever's established, opera, this and this, whatever is sort of institutionalized as, respectable or respected, art in our society. People came up with things that were very contrary to that, but I think the result has been now, here in the 80s, that people say, put them all side by side and say, I like this, I like this, I don't like this, but, so I think that's reflected somewhat in the music that you hear on Windham Hill.
Boy, there are two ways I'd like to go simultaneously with a follow-up question, which is the musical one. Talking about that, consolidating all those diverse influences and so on, I was curious, kind of pleased in reading through some of the biographical material that we have on you folks to find references to more avant-garde or esoteric composers, Mort Feldman and John Cage and people like that. I'd be curious to hear you talk about, if you'd like to, talk about the influence of the new music, as we call it, on your work and how you think it all fits together and what's happening in the music world today.
Well, I'm not, you know, I can't get too academic about it because I'm not really very studied in the whole situation. But, you know, I've definitely tried to expose myself to a lot of different types of music. And, you know, I think what I've noticed, and maybe it's just because I haven't been around long enough, but what I've noticed is that people are really starting to open up and listen to all different types of things. In modern composers, say, for example, the influence of world music has been such a big factor in the last 10, 15 years.
And that's been cropping up among more popular musicians, too. There's a lot of people now that are playing sitar. I mean, I could go for days with radio programs, music programs that have sitar in them, or gamelan.
Well, yeah. I think you can always all go back to, you know, when the Beatles had George Harrison, you know, had, you know, sitar music, and then had the London Philharmonic backing them up, and you know, also like gamelan music from Indonesia has been a big influence, and then you listen to the gamelan orchestra, and then you go listen to Steve Reich or Philip Glass or you know. There's a guy in San Francisco, Paul Drescher, you know, the whole minimalist music scene, you know, you could see a very direct correlation to world music or new ethnic, kind of going back to the roots and looking at different ethnic sources, new instruments, and the result is in modern composition, you see a whole new configuration of instruments as well as a real new direction in music that goes away from I'm careful because I don't know that much about, quote, modern composition. But I always found it a little bit hard to listen to music like Schoenberg or and so forth. And, you know, I've just tried studying that 12-tone music theory and so forth for a while. And I think my objection has always been not to the fact that the music was dissonant or atonal, quote, atonal, but that it was based on a very Germanic and European romantic concept of music and trying to stretch that, you know, to its absolute limit, rather than taking that concept and bridging it with, say, like African music or Indonesian music and taking those rhythms and so forth. So when I hear atonal music presented in a way that I don't hear as being directly related to, you know, the 19th century, what I call the Romantic Germanic tradition, then I can appreciate it more, because it's a new theory of harmony for new rhythms and for a new kind of world approach to music, rather than just trying to take the European tradition one step further.
So, something else connected that, too. You were just talking about dissonant music, and that's something that I've become increasingly aware of. Is for many years, classical music or new music and jazz all were sounding very dissonant, and that there seems to be a lot of people moving away from that into music that is pleasing to the ear, and even lyrical and romantic in the not in the period sense, but
it's a more lyric approach to using dissonant.
Well, of course, the New York Philharmonic has made a big deal out of the so-called new romanticism they've had.
Yeah,
well, they're now beginning their second festival this year. Based on the premise that there is a new romanticism in music. I'm not sure if I buy that entirely. I'm not sure entirely what they mean by that either. It seems like sort of a handy catchphrase. But I think what you're saying is absolutely true, Carla, that it's going both ways. You can take a composer like Philip Glass, say, who is immensely popular now, although he comes out of, among other things, a fairly strict classical training,
right,
academic musical background, yet he's drawing very directly, aside from Eastern influences, he's also drawing on Western popular music and so on. And I think it's working the other way, too, that and perhaps Windham Hill is one very good example of that, where although you may not be borrowing directly from the new music or classical music traditions, it somehow in a general way informs your work.
Well,
I think it gives it a broader sort of background.
The other thing is that as an individual musician and composer for guitar, I always feel like I'm changing too, and I'm learning. You know, I think within that context, I'd have to say that Windham Hill is fairly young or fairly naive approach to that, because it's a lot of it is fairly fairly simple or fairly accessible. I mean, we're not talking about extremely dissonant music here for the most part, and but I think that's natural. I mean, it may be 10 years from now you'll hear some of the stuff on Windham Hill will be very, very dissonant, yet it'll carry on it'll be a continuity with where the music started and where it came from.
I like that comment very much. I appreciate you making that. I mean, I feel, for instance, talking about minimalism, what's referred to, I think, somewhat erroneously as minimal music, Steve Reich, Philip Glass, Terry Riley, and Paul Drescher, and on and on and on. It seems to me that, in a sense, that style of music, as it's presently constituted, can only go so far, and that something else is going to have to take its place, obviously, as these things happen throughout musical history. But it seems to me that perhaps the most significant contribution of minimalism, let's say, and perhaps of what you're doing with Windham Hill as well, in the long run may turn out to be the fact that it is bridging this gap between different audiences, jazz, classical music listeners, rock, all these different elements of the listening public that have been more or less isolated in the past, and this music is attracting new listeners to new musical experiences, opening their ears to the whole world of music. And I think that's very, very exciting.
Yeah, I do too. I think it's a positive sign. I think
my other follow-up on the children of the 60s line of discussion. I don't know if maybe Carl asked this when I was out of the room, but let me ask anyway. You mentioned that A&M Records is now doing distribution for Windham Hill.
Right.
For very practical reasons, I'm sure. The obvious question, I suppose, is will success spoil Windham Hill?
Well,
how are you dealing with that philosophically? It seems like you've come out of a background that has a very strong investment in the cottage industry sort of thing, the independent record label, and now you've become enormously popular as a label and you're being distributed by a larger corporation. And how are you going to handle that?
Well, I think, first of all, only time will tell. I think the positive aspect right now is that even though Windham Hill is being distributed by A&M, and because that's tied in with RCA, and it's a bigger corporation, and they may have different ways of doing things than Windham Hill is used to. The positive aspect is that the agreement between the two companies is such that Windham Hill still maintains total control over the production of what gets recorded, when it gets recorded, how it gets recorded. And that means that the musicians still have as much input into the recordings as they always have. And the A&M, for example, just takes the records as they're produced from Windham Hill and distributes them. Now, if they don't sell well or whatever, then that may in the future mean a renegotiation of the agreement between Windham Hill and A&M. But it doesn't, I don't think, mean that Windham Hill is going to be in a position where they're forced to change their production ideas to conform to a better, you know, sales record for the distributing company.
We're getting the high sign. I'd like to talk for hours and hours. There's so many things I'd like to ask you. But I guess we've run out of time. So thanks a lot, Alex DeGrassi.
Wow. It's been nice being here. Thank you.